This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. PharmaCare legislation was introduced in Ottawa this past week, which initially will allow for free birth control and free diabetes medication for everyone in Canada with a health card. The proposed legislation also lays out principles that would underpin a potential federal PharmaCare plan in the future. It will also allow for the minority Trudeau Liberals to stay in office as part of their ongoing political pact with the federal New Democrats. Provincial health ministers in Alberta and Quebec have already said they want to opt out of the program and would rather put the money toward their existing drug programs. Ontario's health minister, Sylvia Jones, says she needs information from the feds before deciding whether to opt in or out. Our medical record panel weighed in on PharmaCare when Tasha Carradine was filling in for Libby. Dr. Malcolm Moore, he is a medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Centre. Dr. Fahad Razak is a general internist with Unity Health Toronto. And Dr. Elisa Naiman is a family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto.
I feel like some of the dialogue that's occurred in the last week in terms of Quebec opting out, which they always do, and Alberta wanting to opt out, is politics between the federal and the provincial government in terms of who has control and power over healthcare. From a practitioner standpoint, I will say this, that I have patients who aren't covered by the government because they're not over 65 or they're not on Ontario Works or they don't have a private plan and they can't afford medication. And it often becomes a decision about what kinds of medication can they be given that they can afford. And lots of times people cannot afford to take medication and they don't take it. And as we've mentioned in terms of what's the total cost to the system, then it ends up going downstream and then it ends up that they're now getting sicker and they're now going to emerge and now there's more cost. So I just hope that people can access the medication, and as medications become more and more expensive, I think it's a further barrier that we as a society who values access to care and equitable access to care, to healthcare, that this is something that we need to work on.
Dr. Razak, what do you think about the naysayers who say that PharmaCare, the danger in PharmaCare is while there will be access, as Dr. Naiman points out, to medications for people who don't have them, that innovative medicines may not be introduced because they'll be too costly and manufacturers will say, well, the government just won't pay?
I would say the counter argument to that is that we are the only high income country with a single payer system that does not cover medication. So again, we're out of step on this, and you can't make this argument and pretend that we are testing the waters on something that hasn't been tried elsewhere. This has been tried in other countries. They've demonstrated that they continue to have access to cutting-edge medications. Now, cutting-edge medications and the cost of these things will present an enormous problem in general, even if you have private payers for medications. It's not like a private system itself ensures that you have access to these medications as well. Sometimes medications are going to be sufficiently expensive that private or public, there's going to be significant challenges. So I think we're heading as a country towards a model which has been widely adopted elsewhere. Starting with things like diabetes and contraceptive medications, I think is a reasonable start. And as I said, the economic analysis around all of this suggests that overall, the transition to a single payer system will save the system money. But clearly, as you do that transition, there's going to be things like the payment for people who don't have insurance. Now, where does it come from? So there is a lot of complexity here. And I would hope that this will be an area where, even though you're going to see provincial and territorial differences in the way the adoption occurs, that the general pressures from the Canadian public will ensure that broadly over time, we ensure coverage for more and more people.
Dr. Moore, your take.
I'd like to say a few positive things about this. I guess the first thing I would say is I think obviously there was a political part of this. The Liberals had to have a PharmaCare bill by March the 1st because of their agreement with the NDP. But I think the idea they have of starting slowly is a good one, because the complexity of setting up a new system is significant. And I think trialing it out on a small number of medications with the thought that it would be expanded over time makes a lot of sense to me. The other thing is, maybe to take a bit more sympathetic view to the positions of Quebec and Alberta, what those provinces are basically saying is, look, we are responsible to our population for the delivery of health care. And if you're going to put, what they're saying to the federal government, look, if you're going to put $90 million into drug coverage in our province, we're happy to accept the money, but we would like to be the ones making the decisions about what drugs we're going to invest in for that $90 million. And I think, like, when they're saying they want to opt out, what they're basically saying is, we would like the money that's associated with the program, but we would like to run the program themselves. And that's always going to be a tension in Canada when you've got, a federal system where the provinces are ultimately the ones who are responsible for the.
Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist with Unity Health Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the medical station in Toronto. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. The chief executive officer of Advantage Ontario is calling on the Ford PCs at Queen's Park to consider 21 recommendations in their next provincial budget that will focus on older Zoomers. Among the recommendations, increased funding for healthcare workers, including those who work in the long-term care sector, with as much as $309 million towards nurses and personal care workers, and upfront funding for Ontario to build not-for-profit long-term care homes. Where should this funding go, and beyond the budget, what about demographics? A Home Care Ontario report suggests the province will see a spike in seniors, as many as 650,000 in the next 5 years. Lisa Levin joined Tasha Carradine for a discussion on Wednesday.
Our top ones are that we need to address the health human resource crisis that is happening. We do not have enough workers in health care, and it's a huge problem. The second priority is that inflation, as everyone knows, has taken off, and we need to be able to get enough money to our long-term care homes in the province so that they can keep up with inflation and meet their expenses. The third one, because we have four top asks, is that nonprofit long-term care operators need help being able to build and rebuild long-term care homes. And so they need 0% financing and other incentives to be put in place to help them build. And finally, we need to have a more robust continuum of care for seniors, and seniors need more housing options as they grow older. So we're calling on the government to provide more funding for what's called assisted living for seniors.
That's kind of like the missing middle. We talk about that in housing in general, but in this case, it seems to me that missing middle is for seniors who are able to live with assistance in their own home but aren't ready to step into a long-term care facility. How many people, or how big of, a population are we talking about who fall into that missing middle category?
Quite a few seniors who end up in long-term care. Maybe 15 or 20% of them could have ended up staying at home or been in supportive housing if they had options. Every year, I mean, we have 80,000 long-term care spaces for people, and our wait list is around 40,000. So long-term care is a scarce resource, and we need to make sure that we save it for the people that really need to be there. So We need to have more options, and people don't want to go to long-term care if they don't need to be there.
You know, long-term care also has to be quality care, and that means supports, like you said, to make homes either more amenable or build them in the first place. You talk about the government helping long-term care homes get off the ground. Practically, what would that look like?
There is a real difference in quality of care. That's better in the not-for-profit and municipal homes. The money doesn't go into shareholders' hands. It gets reinvested back into care. So in terms of what we need to be able to ensure that we have new and more nonprofit long-term care homes, is they don't have the kind of equity. They're not big businesses. So they need to have help with financing these buildings, just like, you know, a first-time home buyer needs help buying their first home and getting a mortgage. So we're asking the government to provide a zero interest rate construction finance to long-term care homes that are nonprofit, and also more upfront money so that they have the resources to be able to get all the studies done, get the engineering documents, the architectural drawings, and all of those really expensive things.
They can't even find at the government level enough people to work in primary care. How do you compete with all these priorities to make sure that seniors also get their share of workers? What needs to change?
One of the biggest things that need to change is that if you're someone that works in a hospital and you're a nurse or a personal support worker or a food service worker, and if you're doing a similar job to someone working in long-term care or home and community care, which mostly are geared to seniors, you should get similar pay. And that is not the case in Ontario. And it is the case in many parts of the world. So why is that? So that's something that really needs to change so that we can make sure we care for our seniors better.
Lisa Levin, the CEO of Advantage Ontario, in conversation with Tasha Carradine on Wednesday. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, while a parking spot tax might help Toronto recover financially, is it fair to businesses still recovering from the pandemic? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. As Toronto City councillors and Toronto staff continue to plead poverty, they are now reviving an old idea to get more cash, taxing parking spots on business-owned properties. As part of this, city staff wants to charge downtown businesses double what they want from the suburbs. The call comes at a time when many business owners in downtown Toronto continue to struggle as so many people stay home to work, either all of the time or some of the time. Libby discussed the idea with the Tune Into the Town Municipal Panel on Thursday. Alex Blumenstein is co-founder of The Peak. David Crombie is a former mayor of Toronto. And Karen Stintz is CEO of Variety Village.
It's not as if this, you know, parking tax is in isolation from all the other taxes that people are paying. And so it's fine to say, you know, all the best taxes are ones that someone else has to pay. So there's a strong likelihood that, you know, and I run a charity, so, and I have, there's 47 spots that I have in my charity. Am I going to have to now charge people to pay for parking, or do I get exempted because of my charitable status? Right. And then all of these strip malls that are on, like, that are along Lawrence and that are providing a service to the community, are they going to have to pay? Because they're probably not going to be able to pass that cost on to people who are pulling in to go to the restaurant or pulling in to go to the local convenience store, the Tim Hortons. So it's great to say, but then it becomes, why am I doing business in Toronto? Because it doesn't make any more sense anymore. Because the money that I'm getting from the product I'm selling does not offset the taxes I need to pay for what I to have the privilege of operating in the city. So there is a point at which it breaks down, and I think we're at that point with this parking tax, because it's so hard to implement. It doesn't make any sense. It will be a complete burden on businesses because the ability to pass it on to consumers is very challenging. And like, you're going to have to exempt a whole bunch of us because churches aren't going to pay, not for profits aren't going to pay. And so how does that all get reconciled?
Meantime, right? It's hollowed out. It really is hollowed out. And businesses cannot convince employees to come back there. David, what do you think about this?
First of all, the city needs the money. Keep that before your very eyes, because it doesn't matter where they go. In terms of collecting taxes, they're going to find opposition and complication. That's for sure. So it may not be a parking lot a year from now, but it's going to be something else. The city has been in bad shape financially. It's been put in bad shape financially during the last 10 years and has to get out of the hole. So So the first point is it needs the money. Secondly, Karen, I think, is on to a good point, and that is that none of these things are uncomplicated, and therefore the administration of it may be more than the gathering in of the money. So I would hold my fire on yes or no until you see actually how they're going to implement it. But should we say no and just not bother? We can't. We put ourselves in a hole by not taxing, by not having the guts to make sure that we had enough money for what we were spending, and now we're having to pay for it.
Alex, do you think that that's the appropriate thing, to tax, put all these requirements for money on businesses, and businesses that may be perceived as being rich, whether they are or not?
I think the economic term, where is the incidence of the tax lie? I mean, the tax would be, I assume it would be implemented to the person who owns the land themselves, right? Would that be passed along? Perhaps, but maybe not, because even though these people who own land can continue to collect rent, and most of them are quite profitable on this, if it is true that the downtown is hollowed out, then they shouldn't be able to pass that along to their tenants, because the demand for that, that's, you know, economics 101, is they shouldn't be able to pass along the incidence of that tax, right? So I think it's actually lies on the property owners who I'm not particularly concerned about. And then to address the strip mall issue and the smaller businesses, there is a carve out. It's anything below, I believe, 300 square meters, which is 10 parking spots, isn't subject to this tax. So it actually wouldn't hit those smaller lots particularly hard.
Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak, David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto, and Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. It was nice to have Libby back from vacation on Thursday after her return from the DR on Tuesday. But she says upon arrival at Toronto's Pearson Airport, it was chaos, worse than during the pandemic. As Libby pointed out, you would think no one had an inkling that thousands of people were arriving at around the same time. But she says there were very few staffers in the custom hall, that is the jurisdiction of the Canada Border Services Agency. Libby spoke with a panel of stakeholders about the experience. Jason Leader is a conservative strategist and president at Enterprise. Martin Firestone is the president of Travel Secure Inc. And Sean Davidson is a spokesperson for the Greater Toronto Airports Authority.
We are in communication very often with our agencies at the airport. And I know that you mentioned here, for example, your flight was late. And this could be a factor that led to something like this happening on the weekend. So for example, if the CBSA, I don't want to speak too much for their operations, but they would be staffing towards what is expected for the flight volume. And let's say your flight and six other flights arriving from destinations, the airlines had delayed those flights as well. Sometimes what can happen is all of a sudden we now have six flights that weren't supposed to arrive at the same time arriving at the airport. That can cause delays in the customs hall. But when things like this happen, the CBSA can reach out to the Greater Toronto Airports Authority. We are always there to try our best to help assist, and we can deploy a team of people to try and get people through faster. But ultimately, the operation in the CBSA customs hall is up to them.
And something that in the past, I mean, again, it's the border services, where you would have had maybe one agent looking at your receipt from the kiosk, you know, why are three of them now?
There are a number of measures in place that we've put over the last year, because we've taken feedback like this from passengers, and we put a number of measures in place. So the reality is, at the end of the day, on some of our busiest days at Toronto Pearson, there's 150,000 people coming through our doors. That's to put that in perspective, that's like the entire city of Barrie. So there are rush hours. It's no different than like the 4:27 or the 4:01 in the morning. There are peak periods, and we do everything we can to try and manage that flow and work with our agencies to manage their rush peaks as well.
Marty, so are you surprised by the experience that I described?
No, because I can duplicate that experience with one added little twist. also ran into a similar problem. But how do you like this one? It says my bags will be on carousel number 10, and I sit at 10 for a half an hour until I see someone walking out that I was on the plane with and said, they're over on carousel 3. That name was still on 10, Air Canada flight number so-and-so. No announcement that it has moved over to carousel 3, and I'm sitting there like an idiot waiting over a half an hour when the bag was probably out after 10 minutes.
Jason, we've had all these announcements about how all these problems have been solved. But yeah. I don't think they have been solved.
Hit and miss for sure. I think I fly enough that I see a little bit of this. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. The thing that drives, I laughed. There's just inexplicable things happen there, though. I'd be interested in your take. Like, do you remember a year or two ago you walked into that hall and there was all new machines and they're incredibly slow to take your picture, and like the other machines were like a year old or something like that. Like, how many tens of billions of dollars did these machines cost? I've been through it all. We've all been through it all. Those crushing times, it's brutal, and you just. It's inexplicable. You're standing there like herded like cattle. You don't know what's going on. And, you know, there's just no way out of it. That's the worst part. And then there's other times, too, where you come in and the problem that Marty just described, right? Sometimes weather's bad late at night, whatever. It takes forever to get those bags. And, you know, I don't know what you're supposed to do. There's been people that I've been talking to that have, you know, had to wait hours for bags at the airport. And, you know, you hear the horror stories. You don't hear any of the good stuff. But, oh, my goodness. At least the GTAA guy came and faced the music today for you.
Marty, is this what people should expect? We're coming up on March break. That's going to be busy.
Yeah, it's even going to get worse. You remember the old adage, what time's the plane landing, and then we'll get in the car and get out, come to pick you up? I mean, that's out the window now. Even if you could be calling as you're on the runway landing, there could be hours in between that and when you're ready to walk out of the airport. So the bottom line is, accept this. This is evidently the new way of life post-COVID, and it's not getting any better. In fact, it could even get worse. Combination of climate and weather that's going on these days and just all the staffing issues, they're still all there, absolutely.
Marty Firestone, president of Travel Secure Inc., Jason Leader, conservative strategist and president at Enterprise, and Sean Davidson, spokesperson for the Greater Toronto Airports Authority. You're listening to the Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics. And we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. John in Toronto phoned with an idea to bring in more property taxes.
It's likely time that we revisit whether churches and religious entities start paying property tax. Plus, you know, they have a lot of land and they might. It needs to be revisited. It would take somebody with a bit of guts to take action here, but I think it's time to take a look-see at this.
Heather in Barrie phoned during our segment on how one in five people are without a family doctor.
There was a comment made at the beginning of this that the older doctors are retiring. My 45-year-old doctor in Barrie, in a family practice, is retiring. And he is leaving because of the government rules, the government paper, and the government is ruining our medical system. I'm 83 years old, lived in Ontario my entire life, have always had a doctor, and I have many friends that can't get doctors. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Joy in Markham phoned with concerns about aging.
I am going to be 81 in May of this year, and I am still working as a PSW because I want to. And to stay active, I am still responsible for a mortgage, but I'm thinking long-term, what would happen to me with living alone at home, paying a mortgage? What can the government do with my mortgage interest?
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Walter in Hamilton, who phoned with his suggestion about how a federal pharmacare plan should be implemented.
If the government was to set up some kind of medical system, coverage of any kind, that they should balliate themselves around each province and territory and cover only the meds that their system doesn't cover, so that, you know, it would fill in the cracks, so to speak, in the medical world for all of us. And I think that's where they should concentrate first.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at @FightbackLibby and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.